Okay, so this is the Alex Israel on how Ezra changed. If you're interested in how Halach and the Bible, the tension that's across the hall with Marty Lukshin, a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Alex Israel here from Alon Shvut, where my son is learning, and so I'm in the Beis Medrash the other day, so it's always nice to connect. Alon Shvut's a wonderful community of Marbitzei Torah. Many teachers, and it's a pleasure to have you. He grew up in London, England, and as you'll hear from his accent, and he now teaches at Eretz HaTzvi, and the Director of Community Education at Pardes in Yerushalayim. He has authored a number of books. Recently came out the Koran Magid edition on Sefer Malachim, and it's a pleasure to have you. And Vakasha. And by the way, just before we start, I do want to announce, you know, Dr. Lukshin's across the hall. If anybody's interested, he's speaking this evening at a private home on the new Beit Din of Rabbi Kraus for Agunot. So if anybody's interested at the Freudenstein home, I can give you the 8 o'clock this evening. If you're interested, come and see me, and I'll tell you exactly. But that's going to be 8 o'clock this evening, Dr. Lukshin on the Rabbi Krause's, you know, Beit Din for Agunot. So that's okay if I can make that announcement. Thank you.
Okay, good morning. Boker Tov. Thank you to everybody who's come and study this morning, decided to abandon the Pesach cleaning and come and refresh the mind. We're going to today talk a little bit about the personality of Ezra, and even beyond Ezra, the group which he is said to have founded, the Anshe Knesset HaGdola. And what I would like to do is give us an insight into a fascinating period of transition in Jewish history. I would probably put it to be the transition between the era of Tanakh and what we sometimes call the rabbinic period. And I think there's no hero greater when we're talking about this period than the personality of Ezra, and indeed this body that he founded called the Men of the Great Assembly, the Anshe Knesset HaGdola. And that's really what we're going to address in our time today. I hope everybody has the handout. And what you really need to do is turn to the page which has at the top, Why Judaism Was Never the Same After Ezra. I think they just stapled the two pages in the wrong order, but we'll be focusing on this for the first little bit. Are there any spare sheets anywhere, or does everybody have any spare handouts on any of the tables? Yes. All right. By way of introduction, let's give ourselves a little understanding of the historical frame. Many people think, if you ask average layman on the street and you say, when did Ezra live? They might not know, but if they know, they'll frequently tell you that Ezra built the Second Temple. That is actually not true. So I just want to clear up some historical evidence. And then when we've got ourselves in the historical time frame, we'll be able to then start getting into understanding what Ezra's revolution, as I call it, really was. So take a look at the timeline that I've put on the top, just so that we can get a historical frame of reference. If you go from left to right, let's see, 586 BCE is the date that we say that the first temple was destroyed. 586 BCE, the Churban HaBayit HaRishon, and the Jews go off to, we usually say, to Babel, to Babylon, but really they spread all around the region. There were many refugees to different countries, whether it was to Ammon and Moab. And if we read Sefer Yirmiyahu, the book of Jeremiah, we see a huge number of people who went to Egypt. And this is probably the beginning of a Jewish diaspora, maybe even began earlier with the exile of the 10 tribes. That's 586 BCE. I know that some of you think the exile was for 70 years, right? But actually, it was only 50 years later, in something like 536, 535, that the Cyrus Declaration allowed the Jews to return to Yerushalayim, as is described in the last pasuk of Divrei HaYamim, and in the first pasuk of the first chapter of Ezra. Cyrus, this was the changeover between the Babylonian Empire fell And the Persian Empire took over, and the new emperor, Cyrus, had a policy of repatriation and of national autonomy. He believed that instead of pulverizing your enemies and the countries you take over, rather what you should do is give them a chance to rebuild their temples and restore their countries, and if you keep them happy, they'll keep you happy. And this is the atmosphere that we have of the Persian kingdom. We know later that Persian kingdom from the story of the Megillah. But basically 50 years after the Khurban HaBayis, after the destruction of the Beit Midash, Jews are allowed to go back to Eretz Israel. They go back. Tanakh talks about something like 42,300 people coming back from Babel, which is not a huge number of people. It seems like there were further waves. And the first thing they do is lay the foundation stone for the temple. But it doesn't get built for a long time. It doesn't get built for 20 years. And around the year 515, which means that from the time of Khurban until Binyan is about 70 years, around 515, in the sixth year of the king Darius, we have the building of the second temple. Ezra is still not on the scene. Okay, when does Ezra make Aliyah? When does Ezra come? Ezra is somebody who is well known to the Persian government. And in the seventh year of Artaxerxes, or Artaxasta, as we're told in chapter 7 of the book of Ezra, Ezra makes Aliyah. As you can see, just adding up the years, the temple's already been standing some 65 years. The Jews have already been in the country almost a century. However, the situation in Judea, in Yerushalayim, is pretty dismal. What do I mean? I mean that at this point, for example, the walls of Jerusalem are still broken down. Jerusalem looks like a wreck. It looks like, I don't know how to describe it, London after the Blitz. I don't know what. We're told that the walls of the city are not whole. There are no gates. It's not a safe place to live. It certainly doesn't look like a capital city. As regards to the temple itself, it's in the time of Ezra that we get the prophecy of Malachi, where it says that everybody is bringing sacrifices to the temple, which are blemished animals and broken animals. In other words, people are bringing their seconds and thirds, the things that they don't want in their herds, to the temple. They're fulfilling the letter of the law, but certainly not the spirit of the law. The temple isn't being supported, isn't being funded very well. It's really, really pales into what it should be. Shabbat is not being kept. Shabbat in Jerusalem is shopping day. It is the market day when tradesmen of all sorts, because people apparently are not working in the fields, but it's the day when everybody goes to the mall and the streets are filled with the markets and everybody's trading on Shabbat. Doesn't sound very good. And the last big problem is intermarriage. Even the family of the high priest are marrying into local tribes. The situation in Yerushalayim is pretty dismal. And this is the Jerusalem that Ezra walks into when he comes back to Yerushalayim in about the year 457. Pretty bad. And Ezra gets to work. Just to give you a sense, I put another couple of dates here. Hanukkah in 164, just to give you a sense. Then, and the temple destroyed in year 70. Now, we're going to talk not only about Ezra today, but we're going to talk about the body that he instituted. And they are called the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the Men of the Great Assembly. This is a very mysterious body. I say mysterious because we don't have a huge amount of evidence about them. In fact, this period of history, we have very, very little material evidence. Archaeology can provide some sense of the history. We have a little bit of history from Josephus and others. But really, it's a bit of a black hole. Black hole both because there isn't a lot of information in the Gemara, in our sources, and even in other external historical sources, we have very little. And therefore, we really need to reconstruct it from what we know in different Agadot and Midrashim. And we talk about this group called the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the Men of the Great Assembly. The Gemara tells us there were 120 people in this assembly. You might think there were 70, right? But no, there are 120. By the way, that's why the Knesset today has 120 Chavrei Knesset. I'm still hoping that the Knesset will become the Knesset HaGadola. At the moment, they're not doing so well. You know, they've got a lot to live up to. But we actually do not know a huge amount about the Anshei Knesset HaGadola. What I mean is, were they a judicial body like a Sanhedrin, which then they would have 70? Were they legislative? Were they administrative? Remember, most of this time, Jews are under Persian control. But how much did they manage the country? Let me add that when Ezra is sent back to the land of Israel by the Persian emperor, Artaxerxes, he gives him the right to pronounce Jewish law. He gives him the right to pronounce death sentences, fines, incarceration, and everything. So Ezra is given the power of law. So was the Anshei Knesset HaGdola his Knesset, which founded new laws? Was it administrative? We really don't know. But what we will go through today is a series of statements from the Gemara which tell us what changes the Anshei Knesset HaGdola made to Judaism. And I would argue that Judaism comes out very different at the end of this period. I'll say one last word of introduction, then we'll dive into the sources. And the last word I want to say is that how long were the Anshei Knesset HaGdola in sway? So you know what, let's already start with our first source. And this is a source which is probably familiar to many of you because Pirkei Avot is a very popular text. And this is the beginning of Pirkei Avot. Let's start. Moshe kibel Torah miSinai. Moshe received the Torah from Sinai. Umasra liYoshua, viYoshua lezkenim, uzkenim leNeviim, uNeviim masaru ala Anshei Knesset HaGdola. Here we have a chain of what we call Masora, the received tradition, a chain of passing the Torah down from generation to generation. By the way, notice the way the personalities who are mentioned here. First, Moshe gives it to Joshua, Joshua to the elders to the prophets, and then the prophets to the men of the great assembly. Just to understand this, what we're really describing is different periods which we might identify by their books. The book which we associate with Moshe is the Torah. Yehoshua is the period of Yehoshua, right? The generation of the entry. Then at the last lines of Sefer Yehoshua talks about the Zkenim who came after Yehoshua, which probably refers to the period of the Shoftim, right? The book of Sefer Shoftim. And then Shoftim to the Zkenim, to the Nevi'im. The period where the Nevi'im, we don't really see a lot of Nevi'im in the book of Shoftim, but where do Nevi'im come into their own? In the book of Shmuel and Malachim. So the period of the Zkenim is Sefer Shoftim. And Zakenim the Nevi'im. The Nevi'im is the period of Shmuel and Sefer Malachim, which, by the way, in the Septuagint, they actually talk about Shmuel Aleph, Shmuel Bet, Malachim Aleph, Malachim Bet as Kings 1, 2, 3, and 4. Seems like there's possibility that Shmuel and Malachim was originally one single book. So here we have all the periods, and then Anshei Knesset HaGdola refers to Second Temple. Now, what period does this Anshei Knesset HaGdola end? Shimon HaTzadik, in the next Mishnah, which I maybe should have put on, Shimon HaTzadik haya mishiarei Knesset HaGdola. The first rabbinic statements, the first statements we get of rabbis, begins with Shimon HaTzadik, and we start in Pirkei Avot, seeing the actual written, formalized statements by Chazal, Shimon HaTzadik, which again, I'm not going to more or less, but we're more or less talking about the period of Hanukkah, which is why I put Hanukkah on the timeline. What I'm saying is more or less from the period of Hanukkah, we can talk about the first rabbinic statements being formalized, which we can find in the Mishnah. It's a very early strata. It predates Hillel and Shammai, who are around the turn of the millennium. But before Hillel and Shammai, we have all the Zugot. And so I'm saying the Anshei Knesset HaGdola might be seen as a body who cover the period from Ezra to the period of Hanukkah, about 300 years, which is a very long time in which we have very little textual evidence. But this 300 years is what we're going to discuss. So let's see what they did, and let's see what their mottos are. staying in Avot, the first Mishnah, it tells us what they, Heimamru, the Anshei Knesset Allah said, three things, Shlosha Dvarim, Hevei Mutunim Badin, be, in English here it says deliberate in judgment, but in modern Hebrew, Matun generally means moderate, right? Moderate, to be Matun, politically Matun means to be politically moderate. He'emidu talmidim harbeh va'asu siag l'Torah. Establish many students and make a fence around the Torah. So I'm actually going to go backwards in these three statements, okay? And what I'm going to say in the next few minutes, I actually heard from my teacher, Rav Yehuda Amital, and he said, what exactly is this Mishnah talking about? The first one, asu siag l'Torah, make a fence around the Torah. When we talk about this, what do we usually refer to? What sort of things? What did he say? Durabanans. Okay, what else? Gzeirot. Okay, Gzeirot. And the one we think about and we'll talk about later is the things like mukta. Okay, making a fence around the Torah because certain critical issues are being broken. The mukta is a great example. If they're trading on Shabbat, then you want to close down the market somehow and you find ways of doing that. Okay. Before maybe Mekach or Memkar, trading wasn't Asur. And now they say, you know, you're not allowed to do that. And they even go further and make Mukta something which is very, very central. And now there are a bunch of things you can't even touch or move or what have you. And you do that. Might be other areas of Siag. They talk about Shniot La'arayot, bolting down on certain laws to do with marriage and others. We're going to see these, okay? In other words, the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah set themselves up to be, from the start, an activist court. They set themselves up to be a group of people who would expand the Torah, Asu Sag LaTorah, where they wanted to expand it to ensure that the core wasn't going to be harmed. Number two, He'emidu Talmidim Harabeh. What would we call that? Yeshiva, Jewish education. They want to expand Jewish education. And now I get to the third point, which is the first statement, Hevu Mutunim Badin. You don't tell people to be moderate unless they're thinking of being extreme. In other words, this group of people set themselves out from the start to be extreme. I'm not trying to be critical. But what I mean is, the Anshei Knesset Torah know that they're going to make big changes in Judaism. They're fully aware of it. And let's see the sort of changes they make and understand what they do. So let's look at source number two. And it seems like such a innocuous source, very, very simple, but I want to try and illustrate what this change might have been. So it's a Gemara in Brachot, a very simple line in the middle of a discourse. Amalei Rab Shimon bar Abba l'Rabbi Yochanan mechdei anshei knesset l'Torah tiknu lahem l'Yisrael brachot utfilot kudushot v'havdalot. That the men of the Great Assembly established for Am Yisrael brachot, tfilot, right, blessings, prayers, kiddush and havdal. Some of you who may be familiar with the Rambam's first chapter of Hilchot Tfilah will know sort of what they're talking about. Well, let me explain. The Rambam in his first chapter of Hilchot Tfilah explains that in the First Temple times, there were no prescribed prayers. There was no official nusach. The Shmona Esrei, for example, had not yet been written. So there was no unified mode of prayer. Maybe when they went to the temple, they all chanted Tehillim together, right? It could be that many of the Tehillim come from those periods, and when we do see in Divrei HaYamim and other texts that there are gatherings in the Beit HaMikdash, frequently we'll find certain of those statements actually in our Tehillim, like things like Hodu LaShem Kiru B'Shmo, Hodu LaShem Alelotav. We have this idea of certain early texts, but the idea of the Tehillim, the idea of the Shmona Esrei or fixed prayers don't exist during that time. Says the Rambam, everybody used to get up in the morning and they'd say, "Oh, you know, I don't know, Baruch Hashem, it's a gorgeous day. Oh God, give me a fantastic day. I hope all my meetings go well. Hashem, you're so wonderful." That's it. You daven shachris. Many people would like a shachris like that. Especially when we have busy days. He says, the Rambam, that the result of this was, first of all, people came back from the various diaspora communities, and they didn't know a singular language anymore, and therefore people used to pray in different languages. There was no opportunity for communal prayer. And also, people didn't quite know how to express themselves, and that during Second Temple period, the rabbis started creating a more formalized prayer formula. The idea that you'd pray three times a day, the idea that they'd create a structure. By the way, the structure of tefillah, as we know, the Shemona Esrei, starts being set down by the men of the Great Assembly. But we know that even in the times of Rabban Gamliel, post Chorban Bayit Sheni, in the second century, they're still fine-tuning it. And those of you who went to the previous lecture on the Cairo Geniza might be aware that there is, even in the Cairo Geniza, we find many variants of tefillah. It seems like it took over 1,000 years to really formulate the text that we nowadays know. However, the people who started that process and maybe set up the 18 themes and maybe even put together the actual nusach of the chatima of all the ends of the brachot are the men of the Great Assembly. So in other words, here we have the beginning of formalized prayer. Okay, what do we say here? Brachot and tefillot. Well, let me add something more. The idea of brachot. Brachot really bring God into our everyday. Maybe we don't realize it so much because we've formalized a lot of them. But the idea that one would really possibly, the Gemara in Brachot talks about when you open your eyes, you don't say Mode Ani. Well, what do you say, right? You say maybe Pokeach Ivrim, or, when you get dressed, you say Malbisha Romim. When you stand, when you start walking, Hamichim Itzadeh Gaver, right? Every stage of the day, you can say a bracha. I remember some years ago when my son was little, he was 6 years old, he's now 19. But I remember we were be learning Masechet Brachot, and we went on a little tour, a little tiyul in Ashkelon National Park, and there's an ancient Byzantine church, which before that was a pagan temple. And we're looking at it, and we're reading all the descriptions, and we see the crypt where the idol was actually kept, and my son says, Abba, we've got to say a bracha. And I said, what bracha do we need to say? We're at a historical site. He says, we learned it last week in Masechet Brachot. It says in the ninth perek, Sha'akar, when you see a place where there was avodah zara and there isn't any more, you say a bracha, Sha'akar avodah zara me'artzeinu. Thought, should I say it? Shouldn't I? Never said that bracha before, right? I can't remember whether I sort of mumbled it and let him say it, but we get over the crest of the hill and we get a view of the sea. My son said to me, Abba, we've got to say a bracha. I said, what now? He says, Shasata Yamagadol, right? We read it in the Mishnah, right? And the idea that we suddenly have a formula which is able to, you go to them. Nowadays, when we eat a new fruit, we say Shechianu, but the Mishnah says, when you see a new fruit in the marketplace, you say Shechianu, because you've come to a new Zman, it's a new period, a new fruit is coming into the marketplace. Every time you go on a Friday to Machne Yehuda, you'll be saying Birchat Shechianu, because something new is in season, and what have you. The idea that they were formulating brachot, so that Shem Hashem will be in your mouth all the time as you go through your day, and we know the tradition that during your day you're meant to say 100 brachot, which is an amazing idea that Shem Hashem, to create a formal textual way of putting Hashem in our mouth. We already know from Megillat Rut, right? Hashem imachem, yuvarechacha Hashem. But here it was taken a stage further. So we have the idea of formalized prayer where people... Oh, and let me say one more thing about formalized prayer. Once we all have the same text, we can pray together. And therefore it shouldn't be a surprise to us that already by the period of the end of the Second Temple period, we see the development, and you can find archaeological evidence of this, whether it's in Gamla, or you've seen it in Metzada, and other places of Batei Knesset. Now, we all know how important Batei Knesset are for our own communal identity. In other words, this idea of creating a single prayer, a single liturgy, right? And actually founding the institution of the Bet Knesset. All of this did not exist in the First Temple period, and it was developed during the period of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. And we all know how much resilience this has given the Jewish people ever since. How would we survive wandering around the globe for 2,000 years without those institutions, and we know how powerful it is that we can go anywhere in the world and open the Siddur. I know we get irritated sometimes if the Nusach is not exactly our own, but let's really understand that the core tefillot are exactly the same wherever we go, in every continent, in every Eidah, in every community. And this is a remarkable, remarkable thing that the Anshei Knesset Gdolah set down. I'd say more than that. If we take the first two, Kiddush and Havdalah. Again, try and imagine First Temple Jewry. You came home from work on Friday afternoon, right? Sundown, you leave the field. Maybe you live near Yerushalayim. You heard the shofar sound from the Bet Mikdash. And you came home. And then what? Ditto. There's no Maariv. There's not even Karl Bach Friday night, right? There's no shul to go to, right? What do? You go home and you have dinner, right? That's it. Maybe you lit a couple of candles, you know, so you could see. And you go to bed. You wake up in the morning. There's no work, right? Maybe in the village there was a Kriyas HaTorah going on, you know, but it wasn't even necessarily formalized. Maybe a few psukim. Maybe as we read, Lo Chodesh V'lo Shabbat, somewhere the Navi was preaching and teaching, okay? But you just went to bed and then spent the day not working and then went to work the next day. The idea that you have a kiddush where you get up at the table and make this meal special, right? And you actually stand there over a cup of wine where you make it a more formal meal, a more regal meal, and you say, this is why we're doing this. It is Zeichel Yetziat Mitzrayim. It is Zeichel Amaseh Breishit. We have an opening ceremony for Shabbat. I would imagine kiddush is the Kabbalat Shabbat. And you have an end of Shabbat. You have a closing ceremony where you make Havdalah and you light fire to show that before this you weren't allowed to light fire, right? This is a new game. Talk about Hamavdil min Kodesh l'chol. This day is Kodesh, that day is Chol. Imagine a Shabbat where none of our davening existed, right? Where all you did was desist from work and rested. What was Shabbat? You can understand why people went shopping. They had no content. And suddenly they're starting saying, we need an opening ceremony, we need a closing ceremony. So what they're really doing here is forming the foundations of an amazing Judaism. So I just want to realize how this introduction of a liturgy, look groundbreaking change. And again, I think it would be difficult to imagine our Judaism as we can't even imagine what Judaism was like in Beit Rishon times, because we're so ensconced in this world of tefillah and of all the rituals we've created around these. And of course, they're mushrooms, as I say. It's actually funny for us to imagine Shabbos without Kabbalat Shabbat, and we all know that wasn't created before the 16th century. Tzfat, the Chadodi. How would we manage Friday night without the Chadodi? They had Eshet Chayil, that's in Sefer Mishlei, right? I don't know if they sang it on Friday night. All right, let's just look at a couple of other things, and then we're going to try and see how we can take this further. Source number 3, 4, and 5 deal with a different topic, and that is the topic of Sifrei Torah. We said, He'emidu Talmidim Harbeh. So if you want to expand Jewish education, how are you going to do it? You need texts. You need books. And by the way, it tells us that Ezra came back. Ezra, one of the ways he's described, Ezra, by the way, was a Kohen, but he's described as a Sofer Mahir, right? A very powerful Sofer. Now, Sofer doesn't only mean a scribe, it means a Talmid Chacham, because of course whoever could write and whoever was an expert in text was what we nowadays call a Talmid Chacham. We even refer to that in Shemona Esrei when we talk about Pleitat Sofrehem. When we mean Pleitat Sofrehem, we don't mean Sofer as in scribe, we mean Talmidei Chachamim, scholars. But take a look at what Ezra did, Ezra and his men of his great assembly did in order to increase Jewish education. We'll quickly go through sources number 3, 4, and 5. 3, Amar Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, Esrim ve'arba ta'aniyot yashvu anshei kneset dola al kotvei sfirim tzfarim tfilin umezuzot shelo itashru shilmalei mitashrim ein kotvim. The men of the Great Assembly fasted that the scribes should remain poor. This is very rather strange. To be a scribe is a very, very difficult thing. It's very precise work. You know, you're haunched over a book for a long time. It's very difficult. So you need a lot of concentration. I live in a yeshuv where we have a couple of sofrim, And there's one man who's known as a real expert sofer. And I was always very curious about his day, because whenever I got up late and went to the late minyan, he was always there. And when I went to lunchtime mincha, he was always there. And I couldn't understand. You know, he seems to get up very late and always be taking breaks. I thought, when does he write? And when I got him to write my son's tefillin, I didn't ask him in a rude way, but I said to him, what's your schedule like? I always see you in the late minyan. I always see this. So he says, well, you know, I can't write for too long. If I write for more than 3 hours, my eyes start going crazy. So I get up, I learn a little bit, I go to mikveh, and then I daven, and then I go and write for 3 hours. I have my lunch, then I go to mincha, and then I go to sleep for 2 hours. And then I write another 3 hours, right? And then I'm done. He says, I'm a 60-year-old man. I can't spend more than 6 hours a day writing. That's it. You know, that's what I can do. It's a very hard work. If you could, you'd get out of the writing profession. It's pretty tough labor. So what did they say? They wanted to keep, number one, they wanted to keep them poor. Because if they got rich, they'd stop writing. Also, if they keep them poor, right, then the price of books, tefillin, sifrei Torah, mezuzot, are low, right? And then more people will buy. Remember, sifrei Torah, not like we use them. That's how you learn. You need a sefer Torah. Everything's handwritten. It's not like a sefer Torah, something you keep in the Bet Knesset. If you want to read Torah, you need a sefer Torah. So they want more and more of these to be published. So they say, there might be some economists in the room. You might say, well, if you raise the salaries, you'll get more people into the profession. I have thought of that. I was wondering whether this was the best policy. But whichever way, they're trying to induce more publishing, more people to write mezuzot, sifrei Torah, and tefillin, and that's part of what they do. But they do a second thing. Look at the funny text that you see at the bottom of source number 4. And what you see on the left is what we call Ktav Ivri. Ancient Hebrew script. I know you probably can't read it unless you're an archaeologist, but if you find any artifacts from Bayit Rishon, they're all written in the left-hand script. If we ever found Moshe's Sefer Torah, it's likely to be written in the script on the left, because everything we find from early Jewish sources are in this left-hand script. When they excavate in Ir David and they find a seal of a name which pops out of Sefer Yirmiyahu, and we find their actual evidence of their seal, the script is the left-hand script that we don't use. It's called Ktav Ivri. The one on the right, which is the one you probably can read, is called Ktav Ashuri, Assyrian script. By the way, they're the same letters. It's just like, you know, imagine you take the mouse and go over it and then change the font. It's just a different font. They're not different letters. It's the same Torah, it's just with a different font. Now, the Gemara says, I'll read it. Sorry, there's no translation here. Amar mar zutra v'itema mar ukva b'tchila nitna Torah li'Yisrael b'ktav ivri v'lashon ha-kodesh. Originally, the Torah was given in Hebrew, but with the left-hand font. Chazra v'nitna lehem b'mei Ezra b'ktav ashurit v'lashon arami. Ezra was willing to change the Torah, actually restate the Torah in Aramaic, which is unbelievable. He was willing to, like, basically change the Torah and read it in English. And he wanted to change the font. Now, why would he do that? Why do you think he'd do that? Because people couldn't read it anymore. Most people could read the Assyrian font, and it tells you, where do you think the Assyrian came from? The font came from? I'd imagine Assyria, right? In other words, the Assyrian font had become most popular, and that's what most people read. And not only that, but people spoke Aramaic. Ezra said, look, the most important thing is to get people knowing the Torah. Let's change the font. Just get people from. Okay? Am Yisrael said, wait, Ezra, you're far too radical for us. And it says, Biraru lahem Yisrael, Ktav Ashurit v'lashon HaKodesh. That they made a compromise. They said, oh, we'll change the font, but we're keeping it in Hebrew. Okay? V'hinichu lehedyotot Ktav Ivrit, and they left the hedyotot still with the ancient Hebrew font. And who are the hedyotot? Apparently, these are the Samaritans, and indeed, the Samaritans still use this font. So, the Samaritans use the ancient font, and the Jews use this Assyrian font, which has now become what we call Hebrew. We read it this way. That's amazing, right? That Ezra was willing to make these sorts of changes, right? And we don't really have time for source number 5, but source number 5 refers to the fact that Ezra was actually trying to work very hard in order to make sure that the Torah's precise text I imagine they got Sifrei Torah back from all different points in the diaspora, and they had to, maybe certain changes had crept in, because of course these are copied by human beings, and certain changes have crept in. We have lots of sources which tell us that, and that Ezra was trying to unify and make sure he had the most accurate text that he could. I do want to get onto the text of Rav Kook, and therefore I'm going to skip a little bit, but I'm going to sort of review some of the other sources. Let's look very quickly at source number 6. And I'm going to refer to the English side, but believe me, what's in the English is also in the Hebrew, but for now this will do. The Gemara in Baba Kama says that Ezra instituted 10 laws, and amongst them, that the Torah should be read publicly at Mincha on Shabbat, Torah should be read on Mondays and Thursdays, courts should be held on Mondays and Thursdays, clothes should be laundered on Thursday, garlic should be eaten on Fridays, all these strange things. Now, why was he doing these things? So I'm going to relate in order. The first one I want to relate to Kriyat HaTorah. And in fact, the Rambam, by going through the Gemara, tells us that many more changes Ezra made. Let me just relate, and there's a beautiful shir of Rav Soloveitchik on this topic. Let me explain the situation of Kriyat HaTorah again in Bayit Rishon and then in Bayit Sheni. In Bayit Rishon, the Gemara comes to the conclusion Torah was actually read every 3 days, at least every 3 days, right? Well, there's not a 9-day week, so you had to do it Shabbat and twice during the week. So Shabbat, Monday, Thursday. How much did they read? The Gemara says they only read 3 Pesukim. Can you imagine? What would happen was they'd take a Sefer Torah out into the marketplace, somebody would read 3 Pesukim, do Hagbah, probably not even that, right? Close the Sefer Torah and put it back. There was a public reading, that was it. What did Ezra institute? So Ezra said, number one, we should start reading not 3 verses, but 10 verses. Number two, we're going to translate it. They had a Maturgaman. We'll translate it into Aramaic so people can understand it. Number three, we're going to call up a Kohen, Levi, and a Yisrael. Okay? Another change. Number four, we're going to start reading the Torah on Shabbat afternoons. And number five, we are going to read topically. We just read Parshat Parah, Parshat Zachor. We're going to read things that relate to the yearly calendar. What was Ezra doing? And I'll explain it the way that Rabbi Soloveitchik puts it in one of his shiurim, in Shiurim Azecha Abba Mari, where he says that when Moshe instituted Kriyat HaTorah, it was sort of like a declarational statement. The phrase used in the Gemara is, they couldn't go 3 days without water. Likewise, we can't go 3 days without Torah. What do I mean? Oh, here, I'll give you a good example. I don't know if they do it here, but they used to do in Israel when the TV went off. I'm sure now it's 24 hours a day. When the TV went off at midnight, they used to play the national anthem. They do that here? They used to, right? Once in a while, I try not to be up at that time of day, but once in a while, I'm up at 6 in the morning. Usually, I'm on the way to the airport or something. And before the 6 o'clock news on Reshet Bet in Israel, they recite Shema, Shema Yisrael. Right, at 6:02 every day, in a very, Shema Yisrael, in a very dramatic way. But it's every day, at 6:02, they say Shema on the radio. It's one of those things that's remained from the good old Zionist past. That's what Kriyas HaTorah was like. It was like, we are the people of the Torah. It was like raising the flag, singing the national anthem, right? It made a statement. But it wasn't Limud Torah. Rav Soloveitchik says Ezra trying to change Kriyat HaTorah into Talmud Torah. So therefore, you can't, if you just read 3 Pesukim, it's a sort of declarative statement, but it's not a learning moment. But if you read 10 Pesukim, now there's already a section of text that you can understand. Oh, and you know what? In case you don't understand, let's translate it. Unless you think that Torah only belongs to the priesthood, I'm calling up a Kohen and a Levi and a Yisrael to say that Torah belongs to all Israel. Unless you're busy during the week and you don't make it to the market because you're in your field, when are you free? Shabbat afternoon. You've already davened. You've already eaten. You've already had your Shabbos afternoon nap. Shabbos mincha. Everybody come along. That's the one time where everybody will hear the Torah. And you know what? We'll also read it topically so that everybody will find something which will relate to their lives. Ezra wanted to take an old tradition like Kriyat HaTorah and change it into a learning moment. This sort of shows you the sort of thing that Ezra is doing. By the way, Ezra made other changes. It mentions that clothes should be laundered on Thursdays. Amazing. What was that idea? Shabbat, if Thursday is washing day, he closed the washing pools or whatever every other day, but Thursday they were open. Everybody washed on Thursday. Clothes dried on Friday. And everybody had nice, clean, you know, fresh clothes for Shabbat. Amazing. So by village law, he ensured that everybody had clean clothes for Shabbat. Even this, you know, and I don't want to get involved in the relative merits or not of garlic, right? But the Gemara says that why do they want garlic on Shabbat, on Fridays? Because it was to make their wives more attractive. There's some tradition, I don't know whether it's got any connection to French culture and cuisine, but that garlic is something of an aphrodisiac. And that the idea, if the problem was that Jews did not find their wives attractive and wanted to, go off to foreign pastures and intermarry, okay, he will ensure that in Jewish society, they eat garlic. And the Gemara says this was to increase sexual arousal around Shabbat and enhance Jewish marriage. I have no idea whether this was effective or not, but Ezra tried to get involved in this area of life as well. And just to illustrate maybe one last example, is source 7 and 8. Source 7 and 8 talks about the introduction of Muktzah. I'll just read these again in English. Our rabbis taught that at first the sages said you're only allowed to handle 3 utensils on Shabbat. Literally, only 3 things are you allowed to handle on Shabbat. What were you allowed to handle? Right? A fig cake knife, your fruit knife, a soup ladle, and a small table knife. In other words, you weren't allowed to, nothing, right? People, I guess, had their tableware, but other than that, right, you weren't allowed to touch anything. And why did this happen? Rabbi Chanina said this mission was taught in the days of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, for it is written, in those days I saw in Judea some treading wine presses on Shabbat and bringing in sheaves. In other words, people were engaged in treading their grapes, in doing other things. Ezra and Nehemiah said, you're not allowed to touch any household item, only in order to eat your food. That's it. Only for food purposes, but nothing else. And this way, nobody was allowed to touch their carts, their wheelbarrow, their sack, their, you know. And slowly Ezra started Nehemiah, by the way, closes down the market, right? Let me just say, but Ezra, by the way, was a very spiritual person. Nehemiah was an administrator, and they worked together. Rosh Steinsaltz, in one of his lovely articles about Nehemiah, says that Nehemiah was much more effective than Ezra. He says, why? He says, when Ezra saw that everybody was intermarried, Ezra turns around and says, and I cried, and I went down on my knees, and I prayed to God, and I tore out my hair, and I tore out the hair of my beard. He says, when Nehemiah sees people breaking Shabbat, he says to them, If you trade on Shabbat again, I'm going to tear out your hair and tear out your beard. He said, who do you think was more effective, Ezra or Nehemiah? He says, Nehemiah was much more effective. but they were really a dynamic duo, and they worked together, and they tried to make all of these changes. And in fact, this attack on whether the market would be open on Shabbat was so effective that they even made big changes, as you see in source number 8, that we all know that we don't shake the lulav on Shabbat, right? Even if we have an Eruv, we don't sound the shofar on Shabbat, we don't wouldn't read Megillah on Shabbat. And we say, well, why not, right? You could keep the Megillah at shul, you could keep your lulav at shul. No, under no conditions, unless somebody go and carry it through the streets. When was this instituted, right? The men of the Great Assembly. Why? Because they had a war against carrying things in the public streets. Because if you carry things into the streets, again, let's say you're not talking about a monetary economy, but you're talking about a barter economy. How do you work in the market? I take out my pile of fabrics, and you take out your pile of beans. And we say, oh, here, 3 bags of beans for a bunch of cotton, right? And then that's it. And that's how the market works. There's no money. It's just bartering, right? So now you have to make a gezeira on 2 things. Number 1, on taking things out of your house on Shabbat, or actually transporting goods, right? And on kinyan, on kinyanim, right? And maybe on measuring or weighing or things like that. Now, all of those are gezeirot midrabanan. All of those are rabbinic laws. But in order to close down the market, they made all of these laws. And all of these are dated to the times of Nehemiah, the men of the Great Assembly, and these are the sort of things. Now, what I'm saying is our Judaism would be totally different if we didn't have these things. And this is the revolution made by Ezra. And now I'd like to turn to the words of Rav Kook to really understand. This is a beautiful passage. And if you have the textual ability, at some point, if you want to do a lovely chavruta, I would strongly recommend you reading the Hebrew of it. We're not going to have the time to read it so much, but I'm going to summarize this beautiful passage, Chacham Adif Min Avi. It comes from Sefer Orot of Rav Kook. And it's Rav Kook is a very evolutionary thinker. And I think in this passage you'll really see the way that he sees Jewish history evolving and Jewish tradition evolving in a remarkable way. By the way, usually when we talk about Chacham Adif Min Avi, when the Rambam talks about it, he talks about it in a sense of what we would maybe call lo bashamayim hi, right? In other words, we might imagine that it would be great when we have a halachic shaila, what should we do about organ transplants? What should we do about this? If we had a prophet and we'd say, what does God think? And the prophet would say, mutar, asar, it would be great. And we know the famous story about the Tanur Shel Achnai, and when Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua were arguing, and Rabbi Eliezer appears to God, and there was a sign from God who said, halacha is like Rabbi Eliezer, and Rabbi Yeshua stands up and says, the Torah is not in heaven, we have to decide it here. This is a statement, Chacham Adif Min Avi, from the Gemara in Baba Batra, and the Rambam interprets it in the following way. If we're in the Bet Midrash, we're arguing about some point, and in walks Eliyahu Navi and says, it's forbidden, we say, Chacham Adif Min Avi. The sage is greater than the prophet. Halacha is decided by rational means, by rational argumentation, and not by prophecy. God has already given the Torah once, and now it's in our ballpark, and now we have to figure things out using rational argument and using verifiable proofs and what have you. But Rav Kook is going to understand it differently. And let me give you Rav Kook's introduction. Rav Kook compares, or contrasts, I should say, the poet or the artist with the technician. He says like this. Artists know how to describe beauty and sometimes also describe degenerate world. He says, what do artists do? They describe beautiful scenes, passion, love. Sometimes they also rally against injustice, right? You'll have, even now in the world, you'll have, I don't know, Victorian England. You could have William Wordsworth wandering lonely as a cloud through the daffodils. And you can have, Charles Dickens, right? Sorry, I'm showing my British roots here. Talking against poverty and the child orphanages and sweatshops in the crowded city of London. In other words, poets will show the beauty of the world, but also will show when the world is ugly. You'll have, in the contemporary world, songs talking about love, but you also have artists rallying against whether it's for saving the situation of the environment and against global warming or, the concert for Haiti or whatever it might be. Artists get involved in good causes, but can they really change things? In order to change global warming, you need politicians to sign off on this. In order to solve a humanitarian disaster, you need people to know how to fly the aid in, and you need people who are doctors who can actually heal people, and you need people who can, ensure that the situation is resolved and to create housing and what have you. This is what Rav Kook says. Rav Kook says, artists can do things beautifully. They can describe the beauty of life, its dynamism and vitality. They can also describe the evils of life. But in order to really change things, there you need physicians, economists, engineers, judges, and people who pursue practical fields because they really change the world. Who are going to be the poets and who are going to be the engineers? So here's Rav Kook's amazing parallel. The Nevi'im are the poets. What do Nevi'im do? They describe the beauty of God. Yeshayahu sees Hashem, v'shulav mleim et ha'ichal, and he hears the angels saying, Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. Yechezkel perceives the divine chariot. What else do Nevi'im do? They describe when society is falling into the evils of paganism and injustice. But do prophets manage to change society? Very rarely. Very rarely. To a certain degree, the prophets were failures. The Gemara says as much. The Gemara says that the transferal, it's Gemara Megillah, the transferal of Ahasuerus' ring to Haman did more to shake the Jewish people than all the Nevi'im and seven prophetesses. Because we see talk about change and the Churban will happen, and nobody listens. What did the prophets always say throughout the first temple? If you don't stop doing Avodah Zarah, if you don't look out for the poor, what will happen? What will happen? You'll go into exile, and the temple will be destroyed, right? So were they successful? Well, let's look at the litmus test. Did they go into exile? Yes. Was the temple destroyed? Yes. So apparently they weren't that successful. Okay. Says Rav Kook, who are going to be the judges, the economists, the doctors, the whatever? That is Chazal. What do Chazal do? Chazal are Mamidim Talmidim Harbeh. And Al Tikra Halichot Ela Halachot. What do? They expand the law. Maybe let's read from the third paragraph here. He says, but the little lapses out of which was forged the gross body of sin, these were made hidden from the eye of every prophet and seer. It is the practical daily observance of the mitzvot with their detailed laws that will decisively vanquish the darkness of idolatry. Through the observance, study, habituated performance, and love of the law. By the way, I love these four phrases of Rav Kook, where he talks about these four levels, where he talks about Kiyumam Talmudam Heregelam V'chibatam, keeping them, learning them, making them routine. Sometimes we bemoan the routine of halacha, but he says, no, that's very important. And chibatam, and loving the law. He says that after a span of time, they will release the hidden elegance and grace along with a pulse of purely godly living. And maybe go into the second column, and he says, it was therefore necessary to assign the expression of broad principles to the prophets and the particulars to the sages. And as the Talmud declares, the sage is more important than the prophet. And what prophecy with its impassioned and fiery exhortations could not accomplish in purging the Jewish people of idolatry and in uprooting the basic causes of the most degrading forms of oppression and violence, murder, sexual perversity, and bribery, was accomplished by the sages through the expanded development of the Torah by raising many disciples and the assiduous study of the particular laws and their derivative applications. What's Rav Kook saying? Beginning with the Anshei Knesset Gdolah started the flowering of what we call daily halacha. Halacha which applies to every single moment. Do I put my right shoe on first or my left shoe on? When do I say a bracha? When do I say mashi varoch amorad agashem? Did I say yale v'yavo? How much should the kazayat of matzah be? And sometimes we bemoan the lack of vision of this small minutiae. But says Rav Kook, it's amazing, this was more powerful. It's true, the prophets have the grandiose statements, but the only way you're going to change people is getting into the nitty-gritty of their life. By actually getting in there and making all the detailed laws, eventually you get things going. I remember once reading Herman Wouk's book, This Is My God, where he makes a similar point. He says when he was in the Navy, did it make a difference if you saluted in this way or in that way, or if you went down the stairs this way or that? He says, yes, every single detail makes a difference, because when you're at war, every single thing needs to work like clockwork, and getting into these routines is going to make the difference in the long term. He says that's what halacha does. Rav Kook says that dafka, the world of halacha, maybe what we call rabbinic Judaism as opposed to biblical Judaism, gave Judaism resilience and gave it strength to enable Judaism to really withstand the test of time. And the true values of the Nevi'im are embedded in that halacha. And that is why Chacham Adif Min Avi, because it got down to the practical, it got into our lifestyle, Judaism. And that's why the Judaism we know has lasted throughout 2,000 years of Galut, where after 70 years of Galut, after the first temple, Judaism was collapsing. I do want to point the last point that Rav Kook says, where Rav Kook is talking at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, with all of the weight of Zionism and all the weight of the emancipation and reform. Rav Kook is aware that a lot of people in Eastern Europe at that time had really had it with Rabbinic Judaism. You read this actually in some of the early Zionists. The early Zionists, some of them say that why are we so into Zionism? Because Judaism has become too myopic, has become too small-minded. Why are we worrying about every sif katan in the Shulchan Aruch? We want to go back to big Judaism. You want to go back to Judaism which has a land and an economy and an army and a government. That's what we know. We want to go back to Tanakhi Judaism. Rav Kook says there will be a time. I'm in the second paragraph on the second column. In the course of time, the concern with the work of the sages predominated over the work of the prophets. And the institution of prophecy, remember, prophecy is the notion of social justice. I'll put it under two headings. Social justice, spirituality. He said social justice becomes hidden, spirituality becomes hidden. We get so involved in every sif katan of the Mishnah Berurah, the institution of prophecy ceased altogether. After the time, the general principles of prophecy declined. They were imminent in the particulars, but were not readily apparent. In other words, you couldn't see the wood from the trees. At the end of the present epoch, when the light of prophecy will begin to have its revival, as we're promised, I shall pour out my spirit on all flesh, there will develop a reaction, a disdain for the particulars. This is alluded to in the Talmudic statement that at the dawn of the Messianic Age, the wisdom of the sages will become unsavory, and those who live on the boundary, the sages who define the limits in the law, will turn from city to city without finding grace. This will continue until the radiance of prophecy will reemerge from its hiding and reveal itself not as an unripe fruit, but as the first fruits of vitality and life. And prophecy itself will acknowledge the great achievements and effectiveness of the sages, and its righteous humility exclaim, the sage is more important than the prophets, etc. Rav Kook yearns for a time when prophecy will return, not to take the place of the rabbis, but to fuse with the rabbinic Judaism. He says, we need both. We need the big picture Judaism. We need the values of social justice and spirituality. Because the prophets, of course, that was the Dvar Hashem. It was so powerful. However, prophecy making their big statements weren't able to penetrate people's lifestyles. Only halacha was able to do that. However, there's also a danger in overstating halacha, because once we get so involved in the details, we cannot see the wider values. And therefore, we need a fusion of prophecy, of spirituality, of social justice, of big thinking, with the minutiae, with the nitty-gritty of the rabbinic Judaism. And that fusion, the way he calls it in the last Pesukim, he quotes Pesukim, mercy and truth have met, justice and peace have kissed. Truth, which is the law, the rabbinic Judaism, will rise out of the earth, because that's something earthly. We create the halacha. The mercy will show itself from the heaven. That's prophecy. The Lord will bestow what is good, and our earth will bring forth its bounty. And he sees this as the revival of Moshe Rabbeinu, because Moshe himself fuses, if you want, the nevuah with the halacha. This is Rav Kook's vision. By the way, I just want you to see how Rav Kook has it's almost a magnificent tracing of Jewish history. From the period of Nevuah, which was so connected to the inner spirit of Hashem, where Nevuah tried to talk to the people, but the people wouldn't listen. The people didn't understand how to translate those lofty ideas into the practicalities. Ezra, who realizes the flaws of this system and tries to bring Judaism, make it much more practical, much more detail-oriented. And this, of course, continues through the writing of the Mishnah and the Gemara till we get to the Shulchan Aruch, Rishonim, Achronim. Right? And then Rav Kook is saying, wait, this is getting too imbalanced, and now we need to return and rebalance it with a sense of big picture Judaism. I always feel, although Rav Kook wrote this, I think even before he got to Eretz Israel, there's much of that which goes on in Israel today, and I see a lot of reemergence of spirituality and what have you, and people searching for that recalibration of big picture and of small detail of the values of the Nevi'im with with the details of halakha and trying to remarry those different concepts. So this is the journey that we have gone on. Ezra, the revolutionary, and I think you will agree, Judaism was never the same after Ezra. I hope this has given a certain amount of perspective. For me, this has, as I say, deeply affected my own personal Shmirat Mitzvot in many ways. When I feel sometimes a bit, you know, frustrated with sometimes some of the restrictions or requirements the halakha makes on me, I always return back to this text and remember that even though we yearn for those true values, really it is that personal discipline, that daily discipline which halakha gives us, which keeps us in check. And vice versa, when sometimes I feel that I'm getting too involved in worrying about this and that, it's always important to step out, open your Tanakh, read a parak from Yeshayahu, and to gain a sense of the big picture. Thank you very much. Chag Kasher V'Sameach.